This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Later on today's show, we'll hear about the Pay It Forward Farm. But first, the number of suicides in the U.S. has surged to the highest level in about three decades, with more than 40,000 people taking their own lives each year. National Suicide Prevention Week starts on Monday, and joining us to discuss suicide and how to prevent it are Associate Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine and Director of Psychiatric Consultation Services for UC Health, Dr. Cheryl McCollum-Smith, and Assistant Professor in the UC College of Allied Health Sciences School of Social Work, Dr. Jennifer Wright Berryman. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Cheryl and Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you for having us on.
Cheryl, the statistics that were just released in a federal report show that suicides have gone up 24%. Since 1999. What have we been seeing locally? Is it following a similar trend?
It's difficult to follow locally. I think that, because a lot of people are presenting with suicidal ideation and suicide attempts in the hospital. We're certainly seeing a large number. It has not been decreasing, and especially with the opioid epidemic and substance use issues and having a need for mental health services in the community. There's a strong need and a lot of people in crisis, yes.
Talk about that a little bit more, the relationship between substance abuse and the risk of suicide.
Well, we know that all mental illnesses and many social stressors, but all mental illnesses predispose individuals to being suicidal. Mood disorders predominantly, depression and bipolar disorder. But we also know that substances significantly impact people's mental stability. When people are intoxicated, they're at very high risk for self-harm. And when people are in withdrawal states, they're also at a very high risk period. People trying to go through opioid withdrawal, it's a pretty miserable condition. People are quite ill, and it affects their mental state as well. They can become suicidal, and people have difficulty getting help for their substance use, which makes them feel hopeless. Things like heroin are very difficult to get treatment for and to come off of, so it can make people feel hopeless and suicidal. So it's a significant factor that we're seeing a lot.
Jennifer, from your perspective, what do you think might be causing this increase that we've seen?
Well, I think that, from a community perspective, we also have an issue in terms of access to care. So although we have an increase in people obtaining insurance and things like that, we still do not have an increase in resources available for folks who have mental health and substance abuse treatment needs. And that certainly is a huge barrier for folks who have immediate care needs. They can't just necessarily walk right into someplace other than an emergency room and receive immediate care for suicidal ideation. And sometimes thinking about going to the emergency room is daunting. So I think we still have more creative ways that we need to come up with to be able to address those acute needs related to suicidal ideation and intent.
Can economic factors play a role in this as well? How big a role does the economy play?
Well, certainly people who are living in poverty have less access to resources than people who are not. So that is certainly an issue, although we've tried to mitigate that with more affordable health care plans. I don't think we're quite there yet. So there is definitely a disparity that still exists between people living in poverty and people who are not.
Cheryl, is there any one particular group that's more prone to commit suicide? In other words, who is at highest risk for suicide in the United States?
Well, we know that what we need to do to prevent suicide is to treat mental illness, to identify and provide treatment for depression and bipolar disorder, substance use disorder. So anybody with a depressive illness, mood disorder, and any mental illness. So, and we need to be able to identify people who are suicidal quickly, you know, and get them into help quickly. So I think those are the main, as was brought up, we need to be able to get people access to care rapidly. Right now, we can get people into emergency rooms, and we have inpatient, but it can be difficult to get people into outpatient therapy and outpatient medication management.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. Jennifer, are men or women more prone to commit suicide?
Well, men, largely, if you're looking at this as a global issue, but if you look at subpopulations, for example, in our veteran population, the recent report that just came out in April in terms of suicide among our veterans, we're seeing that our female veterans, in terms of the increased risk, is about 85% greater than it was 10 years ago. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done in our subpopulations. So Cheryl's talking about our population of folks with mental illness or mental health issues. We also have veterans. We have youth. We have our elderly populations. And so within those subpopulations, we have varying types of risk and varying levels of risk based on a variety of factors, some of which we've talked about, gender being one of those, yes. Certainly socioeconomic status, social support is also a huge factor in terms of people being able to access immediate help. So having those resources in place is certainly one of the most important things we can do as a community to help people have options.
Are men more likely to commit suicide because typically they're more reluctant to ask for help?
Certainly, that's a theory. I mean, that's something that has been discussed a lot in the research in terms of help-seeking differences between men and women. Women are more natural help seekers. And then they're also in the literature, it looks at means. So the means by which someone would take their own life may be different between men and women. And because those means may be different, actually dying by suicide as opposed to having a suicide attempt could be more successful with a population that used more violent means.
Right. So access to firearms is
right.
One of the most significant factors. So I would say if someone has a suspicion that they have a family member who's in distress, might be having thoughts of harming themselves, might be acting differently, withdrawn, if there are firearms available, one of the most important factors someone could do would be to secure those firearms. The VA, I know, gives out gun locks. Other people, you can access gun locks or just secure the firearm, secure the ammunition, and make sure that someone that you're concerned about and are in the process of figuring out what's going on does not have access to lethal means while you're in the process of getting them help.
Cheryl, something that I always wonder about, the idea of how seriously should someone take it if they're having suicidal thoughts? Is it common for people just to try to dismiss it and to work their way through the thoughts?
Right. I think that anyone who's feeling suicidal that should be taken seriously, and they should be able to be seeking out and getting help and support and further evaluation about what's the cause of that. If you're in ongoing treatment and working with a therapist, that's a different issue from never having been evaluated. So I think anyone who's feeling suicidal should seek, you know, further support and guidance and evaluation to try to sort out sort out what's causing this and if there's something that can be addressed through therapy or medications. There's a variety of different avenues. I think people feel like there's just one thing that's going to happen to them, and I think there's a variety of different solutions when people are having suicidal thoughts. It doesn't just mean you're going to be admitted to the hospital. Some people can be connected to a therapist or connected to a psychiatrist and get good treatment.
Jennifer?
Yeah, I would like to add to that in saying that you know, some of the other options for Intercept are at the community level too, and that in terms of treating each suicide risk seriously and individually, we need to be prepared collectively as a community and be emboldened to ask those questions. So if we have a friend who's in distress, we do not have to be a mental health practitioner to be able to take the threat seriously and to be able to address the threat by asking those questions like, are you thinking about killing yourself? And engaging someone in that conversation and being aware of your resources so that you can assist them in seeking help.
Why isn't there more discussion about this issue, Jennifer, and more conversation about this issue?
Well, I'm glad you asked. Well, there are two responses I have. First of all, we still have very pervasive stigma around mental illness, around suicide, around these things that people do not feel empowered to address inside their own families as well as their neighbors and people in their community. And so the stigma people release themselves from the responsibility of doing anything, of taking action. And it becomes a silent epidemic, a silent, you know, conversation, very swept under the rug. However, the flip side is that we are now recognizing that the conversation needs to be had. And recently, Ohio passed House Bill 28, which requires all higher education institutions to begin a suicide prevention, intervention, postvention initiative. And so in response to that, all of our higher education institutions here in Ohio, including University of Cincinnati and others, are meeting that requirement and instituting. And so our college communities are responding. And so we need to extrapolate that then to our neighborhoods and our faith-based communities and all of our other communities.
Cheryl, your thoughts in terms of the stigma surrounding suicide?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of stigma still around mental illness. And the way I describe suicidal ideation is more like a brain attack. I would like for us to treat this more like we would treat a heart attack or a stroke. It's our psychiatric crisis. It's the life-threatening event in mental illness, similar to having a heart attack in if you had high blood pressure or stroke. So it would be nice if people didn't have so much shame. I think there's a lot of shame for people that if we can, and I think people are scared to ask and scared that they will offend someone. But I think asking the questions doesn't make somebody more suicidal. You'll just find out more information that you can use to be able to help a family member in crisis. So you can ask questions about, like, have things been feeling so bad lately that you have thoughts about just not wanting to be here? Then you can ask if you had thoughts about harming yourself. And it's important to ask if someone has a plan. You know, have they done something, like gotten medications together or things like that? And they're difficult questions to ask, but I think if we can start asking them and start having the conversations, then people can be more comfortable than we think in talking about it.
We will continue our conversation. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition. Thanks to Daryl Anderson for listening to 91.7 WVXU today. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining us to discuss suicide and how to prevent it are Associate Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine and Director of Psychiatric Consultation Services for UC Health, Dr. Cheryl McCollum-Smith, and Assistant Professor in the UC College of Allied Health Sciences School of Social Work, Dr. Jennifer Wright Berryman. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Cheryl, what are things that family members should be looking for? What are some of the warning signs they should be keeping their eyes open for that they might have a loved one who's contemplating suicide or at risk of suicide?
Well, I think it's important to watch for signs of depression, someone who's seeming more withdrawn, more sad, not interested in the normal activities that they were normally interested in, someone who seems to be hopeless. We know that hopelessness is an important factor. Someone who seems to feel like things aren't going to get better and not hopeful about the future. Changes in behavior like that are important to watch for. Sometimes people are also the opposite, getting more edgy or angry or irritable and on edge. So you can see that as well. I think that may be underappreciated. People who are being more irritable, on edge, not coping as well, and with a lot of things going on. So to check in with people, see how they're functioning, how they're thinking about things.
Cheryl, does someone who's suicidal always give you clear warning signs, though?
I think that's one of the difficult things, is that right now we don't have any objective tests. We're working here at UC on Cincinnati Children's, John Pestian, working on some more objective tests, like looking at how people's voice patterns or facial expressions look, to try to tell who's suicidal and who's not. Because right now, the only thing we have to go by is what people are telling us and looking at their patterns of behavior and how they're interacting and how they're functioning. That's why it's so critical, as has been brought up, to have family members and community members engaged. And if they notice a change in behavior, someone acting differently or not engaging, acting very depressed or hopeless, to reach out to them and to help engage and get them help.
I think it's also important in terms of our youth. The research shows that our youth go to other youth. And so when our youth are in distress, they are more likely to reach out to a peer. And in our new age of social media, they are also doing things like posting their distress on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram or Snapchat. And so their friends are on the receiving end of these distress sorts of calls. And so again, from like a public health perspective, it's increasingly and becoming more important to educate our youth on how to be recipients of these distress calls through social media, how to embolden them to talk to an adult, and how to perceive each distress call as an important call and not something to just take lightly. So I think that when we see risk factors changing and evolving with the use of social media, we should take that into consideration as something that we should look at, and we should study and educate kids more.
513-419-7100. Jim in Oakley joins us now. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you? A couple Good. Comments. I'm a family therapist now, as a clergyman for 35 years, so I both saw suicide as a clergy person, and I deal with families now, and if the issue of suicide comes up, I make a referral, and I have people to whom I refer them. But a couple comments. One, Xavier University just sent out a survey to all their students, and I know a couple from Xavier, and one of the persons actually went to counseling because she got the survey from Xavier, which was sent out to all their students, about their emotional life. And I think that's good. I wish they'd do it for seniors in high school, because that's a transitional period. The second point is, I'm 82 years old, and I know being 82 is not easy. So far, I'm lucky. Suicides over 65 now are increasing egregiously, and I don't know if your panelists know that. But the issue of death with dignity, the issue of being older and knowing you're not going to live longer, being depressed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, financially, that's another issue that's coming up more and more, and I think your panel probably is aware of that. The other, and finally, are millennials who can hold six or seven jobs during their lifetime. That's depressing as hell, and I know, talking to a lot of millennials, which I do, the frustrations there about what life they have lying ahead with money, no job security, et cetera, is also an issue. So it's a good discussion. Keep it up, because everybody needs to hear about it. It's an epidemic. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Jim, thank you very much for the call. And Jennifer and Cheryl, you can go ahead. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think Jim makes an excellent point that we have so many, again, groups of people that have special needs that require attention. You know, we have our seniors and our older population who are at a different life place and life crisis than our 16-year-olds who are having serious relationships issues and bullying and some of these other things that could promote thoughts of suicide. So he makes an excellent point that this conversation has different meanings for different groups, that we need to be talking about it in general, but also specifically about addressing the needs of these individual groups.
I think, this is Cheryl, I think the most important thing I'm taking from what you're saying is that we need to recognize that depression can be treated regardless of the cause. So if someone's being bullied and is depressed, needs therapy, perhaps, you know, that can be addressed and treated. These aren't just normal life events that you just have to tough it through. And I think depression is very under-recognized and under-treated in the over 65 age category, because people feel like if you have a chronic medical illness, that's just a normal progression, is that you're depressed. But the evidence shows that I can identify depression and we can treat it. We can improve people's quality of life significantly and prevent bad outcomes.
513-419-7100 to join the conversation. And Janet in Finneytown joins us now. Hi, Janet.
Hi. I wanted to find out, there was a grand round a few weeks ago, or a few months ago, up at UC, and a researcher from Columbia came down, talked about the biological components to suicide. Do you have any more information about that?
This is Cheryl. So I think that was John Mann from Columbia.
Yes.
So there are very few biological markers that have been shown, you know, so lab tests you can do. So, and there's nothing that have been shown in research studies to be associated. There are some gene variants that have been associated with the higher suicide risk in the serotonin receptor, and there are some markers in the cerebral spinal fluid that have been identified, and groups have been looking for a long time to try to come up with more of a biological marker, but right now we don't really have anything that we can use. If you come in, you know, to the doctor's office, there's no lab test or measurement that we can do at this point. But that is certainly an ongoing area of investigation in Columbia and groups here at University of Cincinnati and nationwide. And through the, I'm involved in the National Network of Depression Centers, and we're starting a number of studies. University of Cincinnati is a member of the National Network of Depression Centers, and we're part of some large-scale studies looking at what we're calling biomarkers, which would be these types of blood markers, laboratory tests you could do that would help identify people at risk. So there's a lot of active research going on, and we're very hopeful that this will give us some more objective measures to help us identify who's at risk.
Cheryl, do we know if the risk for suicide can be inherited? I mean, is there any kind of a genetic factor involved?
Well, when we're looking at your prediction of future risk, the two of the strongest factors are if you've had past suicide attempts, that puts you at much, much higher risk, and having a family history of suicide or suicide attempts certainly puts you at a higher risk. And, you know, we're not clear on how much of this is biological versus psychological versus just even the family tendency with mental illness and depression, because there's a genetic risk for depression and bipolar disorder and all mental illness as well. So it's difficult to sort that out, but we do know that having a family history of suicide or suicide attempts puts you in a much higher risk category. Yes.
Let's talk with Sabrina in Oxford. Hi, Sabrina.
Hi. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, I'm in my car. I'm from Oxford, Ohio, and I'm involved with several different groups, including the Oxford Area PFLAG chapter. And one of the populations that you haven't discussed is the risks and vulnerabilities of the LGBTQ+ youth. And we are working hard up here to create community awareness that there are places to go for people in the schools and for parents who are struggling with their children's gender and sexual identities. We are involved with a lot of things with Miami University, including the national It Gets Better campaign, because suicide is not all about mental health issues. It can also be about not being accepted for who you are in your community.
Jennifer.
Sabrina, is that right?
Yeah.
I'm so glad you brought that up. I was just at a suicide prevention conference and listened to a man from Northwestern University who talked about his research with the LGBTQ population and suicide risk. And he is doing amazing work with his group right now and looking at both risk factors and resilience among youth who are coming out and going through these processes and these things that you're talking about. And I agree. I think there's so much more work that needs to be done both on the research side and the advocacy side in terms of our LGBTQ youth. And as a community, we need to educate and make people aware about the resources for our youth who are coming out and who are going through crises at that moment. And we need to focus on specific resources and places of safety and plans for these youth to be able to navigate those times and to think about options other than suicide.
Sabrina, thank you so much for the phone call.
Thank you.
Let's talk to Judy in Montgomery. Hi, Judy.
Hi. Thanks for letting me talk today. I just wanted to share that I have struggled with depression for 25-plus years now, kind of onset with puberty. And over those years, I've tried a variety of different treatments, whether it be, you know, talk therapy or medication. And I, you know, as my life has progressed, I've had different triggers that have set me off to have me consider things like suicide. But my point to this is that what I think it really comes down to is that one treatment is not the answer for everyone. And, you know, over the years, I've had well-meaning friends say to me, "You have a great life. Why are you feeling this way?" Or, you know, things like that. And really, it wasn't until I was pregnant with my second child and my OBGYN sat down and talked to me and said, you know, it's okay. You know, some people will spend their life on medication because it's almost like a vitamin deficiency. You know, you need something that your body is not providing you. And once I felt okay with who I was and what I needed, I have spent the last 5 years as happy as I've ever been, with not a single thought of hurting myself or doing anything rash. And as long as I stay on my medication, and as long as, you know, I am accepting that that's who I am, I feel great. And that's worked for me. So, you know, I just think if you're out there and you're struggling, you know, keep looking for somebody who is the right fit for you, who will help you accept you for who you are and help you find the treatment that works for you.
Judy, thank you very much for the phone call. We really appreciate it. And Cheryl or Jennifer, did either of you want to comment?
I think I'd just like to leave everybody with the idea that it's always okay to reach out to people who are in distress, to ask those important questions, and to assist them in seeking help. I think that being afraid of what someone may do puts us in an uncomfortable spot, and we have to wrestle with that. But I think it's really important for us to reach out.
Cheryl?
Yes, I'd just like to echo that it's important to get evaluated to figure out what is going on, just like it'd be important to be evaluated for any medical condition, and that depression and mental illness are medical illnesses, as Judy was pointing out, that are treatable. If we can engage people in treatment early and monitor them, we'll have much better outcomes.
One last phone call, James in Kenwood. Hi, James.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good, thank you.
I just want to make a comment about depression. I have a friend who's been suffering from that, and she's a female, and she is a nurse. What I find alarming is that certain things should be advocated as well, as like getting out of bed in the morning, even though you may not feel like it, associating with your family, and people who are ostracized in one group should just try to join another group and never feel like this is the be-all group, that you have to be accepted by these people and nobody else. I just find that depression, there's so many different levels to helping a person with that, with therapy, with going to group and talking your feelings out, but there's just physical things that you have to do, because I know from time to time I suffer from depression and have even thought of suicide, but I quickly dismiss that, and I ask myself, which analyze myself with questions, how long have I been in bed? If I've been in bed all day, moping around, doing things, but when you get out of bed, you get started doing something physical, it seems to counteract a lot of those things.
And I think it's important, too, for friends to keep an eye out for their friends that they know are struggling and might be having suicidal mm-hmm. thoughts. Right, James?
Yes. And one question that I do have is that when I talk to this individual, I try to stress to her to continue to have therapy. And when she texts me and says she's just been lying in bed, I try to get her to get up and associate with her family. If they can just somehow do those physical things, those little small things, that can help with our depression and our moods as well. One thing I wanted to ask the panel about, I used to be in a major religion, Jehovah's Witnesses, and I stopped on my own not going. But I find that when you leave a structured religion and you feel ostracized, the key is to find other friends outside of that organization. And I think that that's what most people, when they get into depression, if they lose a spouse, to lose someone that they love, which can be very traumatic. The reality is that as sad as this may sound, they can be replaced, and people have to look at the brighter picture. I wanted to get your comments on that.
Okay. Thank you, James.
It's a good point that you're making, James, that whenever we have a major life transition, whether it's leaving a community that has been wrapped around you, whether it's losing a loved one, those major life crises can certainly put us in a place of darkness or change how we feel. And sometimes we think about doing things that we would not think about otherwise. And so I think you make a very good point there.
Yeah, I think all of these points are really important, that We know that social connections are really important for our mental well-being. Things such as exercise are very important. Exercise has been shown to be very beneficial. And therapies, there's a lot of variety of therapies. I think James brings up some really important points about therapies. My husband always says it's like ordering a pizza. If you don't like the first pizza you get, you'd get it from another pizza place. So it's kind of like that with therapy. There's a lot of different varieties of therapy. Not all of them are just talking about things that are going wrong. Some of them are very focused on getting you out of bed, working on doing more activities, working on specific problems. There's problem-solving therapy, dialectical behavioral therapy, which works on coping skills. There's interpersonal therapy that works more on your relationships, and cognitive behavioral therapy. So there's a lot of different types of therapy out there that can address a lot of different issues and help people regain those social connections and help solve problems that are going on in their lives. And we know that therapy and medications are the best solution for helping people get out of depressive episodes.
Cheryl and Jennifer, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you for having us.
Associate Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine and Director of Psychiatric Consultation Services for UC Health, Dr. Cheryl McCollum-Smith, and Assistant Professor in the UC College of Allied Health Sciences School of Social Work, Dr. Jennifer Wright Berryman. Coming up, how the Pay It Forward Farm is helping people in communities around Dayton, Ohio. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.